Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to the Script Blast Screenwriting Podcast. I am Hudson Phillips, a screenwriter and producer from Atlanta, Georgia. My goal is to help you write better screenplays and write a better life. The theme for season one is productivity. Clarifying what you want, how you're going to get it, and how you're going to keep it going. Today, we're going to be discussing habits, how to take those goals and turn them into daily activities that are as reliable as brushing your teeth or feeding the dog. My guest today is R.B. Ripley, a screenwriter who previously worked in development for Cruise Wagner, Paramount, and Disney. His pilot, Sugarland, which he'll be telling you about in the episode, is currently under development. His feature directorial debut, Burying the Littlemans, is scheduled to shoot this summer. He has twice been a finalist in the Disney ABC writing program and was a grand prize winner in the Finish Line Script Competition, which I'm a big fan of. Such a big fan, actually, that I got you guys a 25% off coupon code if you go to finishlinescriptcomp.com and click on Film Freeway. You can enter with the code ACA25 to save 25% off my very favorite screenwriting competition. I had a fantastic time talking with Rob about his journey and how his first life as a musician prepared him for the daily habits needed to pull off being a full-time screenwriter. Let's jump into it. All right, Rob, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so today I would love to talk about just kind of daily habits and why that's important for writers, and maybe why writers miss that so often, that a lot of times writers see the romantic side of writing of like, oh, I'm going to write when I feel like it. But for the real professionals in the world, it really does take a habit and treating it like a job. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your kind of journey as a writer and what your background is and all that.
Well, I have kind of an eclectic background. I'm sort of nomadic. I lived all over kind of in my 20s and early 30s. I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In the middle of high school, we relocated to Texas because of my father's job at the time. And then I've also spent time in Wyoming. I lived in Boston, New York. And back here in LA, I've been here for a while since I finished graduate school. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite place that you have lived?
You know, I don't have a favorite. What I find is, you know, there's so many cool things and great people everywhere.
Right. Yeah.
And the big thing that I've learned about moving around is it takes a while to sort of find your version of whatever city you're in. Kind of trust a little bit of time and explore and. You know, you find other people that you kind of mesh with and things that really kind of set you percolating and bring joy to your life. But it takes time to find that stuff out.
Yeah, that's a really great perspective, because I think especially a lot in creative arts, you move to a new place and you think, oh my gosh, I'm all alone here. And so many people that are part of our Script Blast group kind of feel that pressure of like lack of community. And I think the internet has helped that a lot. But I really do think that if you got out of your comfort zones and really sought out that community, that it's available just about everywhere.
No, you're right. And you know, especially now with with technology, there's so many ways to connect with people. And like last year, I was in London over the holidays. It was a year ago. And it was great because I actually met up with a couple of other writers and people in the industry whom I had met either via Twitter or, you know, some other online forum, and had coffee and lifted a pint with them. And it was just amazing for me, somebody who is just inherently introverted. Left to my own devices, I would.
As many writers are that I find.
Yeah. And, you know, I would, left to my own devices, I would sit here and either write or watch great TV or read a book. You know, that's much more comfortable for me. So it's, you know, when you get out there and you meet people and stretch yourself, it pays dividends in really unexpected and interesting ways, for sure.
That's great. Yeah. So, you mentioned going to school. Did you go to school for writing or something completely different?
I did my undergraduate degree in music.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I abandoned that in my mid 20s because I had been doing it since I was like 7 or 8.
What kind of music?
Classical.
Okay.
And yeah, and it was it's funny because it's so competitive. It kind of makes the entertainment industry look like kindergarten.
A cakewalk.
Yeah, it's right. Kind of strange how
that's funny.
Competitive it is. I burned out and I walked away from that after I discovered theater. And I just kind of knew like, okay, this is somewhere in this space is where I'm meant to be playing. And it took me a while to figure out exactly where, but it's definitely storytelling. And so I did my undergraduate in music, left that. And then I went back as a mature student to get my graduate degree. I got an MFA in writing.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, in dramatic writing. Yeah. And so that it was a really smart decision for me because I was older, because I didn't spend my teens and 20s toiling over scripts, and even watching a lot of stuff because I came to it late. It helped me because it was sort of like an accelerant for in a very compressed period of time, forced me to kind of learn a lot of foundational stuff that I could have dickered around with for years and years and years if I didn't go. So for me, that was helpful and almost balances out the student debt that I incurred.
Yeah. So do you recommend school for people who are wanting to do writing?
I think that's such a highly individualized choice.
Right.
Because
it sounds like for you, you were at a place where you knew that's what you wanted to do. It wasn't like you were 18 and trying to figure it out. Right?
Yeah. And, so I think I went into it with a bit of an urgency that I know, when I was younger, I would have never done that. I really screwed around when I was an undergrad. It was truly me figuring out a little bit about myself and kind of my worldview much more than it was about learning what it was I was supposed to be learning. It's like, I recommend it if you're kind of in a place to do it. The hard part though, unfortunately, is financially, it's almost impossible to do it now unless you're independent and wealthy.
Right.
Also really too, true. With technology, I think there's a lot of other options now that can kind of get you most of the way there. I just knew that because I was a little bit older, I was in my late 30s, that, my earning, the period of earning potential was shorter than most. So I was like, well, what's going to get me there the quickest? Where can I get a really deep dive? And also put myself with really smart people. And that was truly that's been the part of the investment that has paid off the most are the people that I met who are now working.
Yeah. And that's what I constantly hear about school. The best part of it is just making those connections, and you're kind of forced to be thrown in this creative environment with other creative people.
It, for sure. And those people also, the way that our program was structured, it was critical in a great way. It was set up. There were only five of us in a class, in our writing class. And it was like a writer's room.
Cool.
It just prepared me to sit around and be given notes by everybody, from very on point to kind of completely ridiculous, and learn how to just take them and consider them, keep what's pertinent and throw away what isn't, and say thank you. It was a great experience. So
that's great.
But I think, had I done that 10 years earlier, I would not have made what I made out of it for sure.
Right. So growing up, what was your big dream then? Were you hoping to be like a concert, like violinist or something like that? Or composer? What was the music side that you were passionate about?
I just loved playing. And honestly, what I really loved about it, it wasn't a big plan as a kid. I wasn't one of those kids who was driven to be, okay, I'm going to play the piano concerto, Brahms Piano Concerto at Carnegie Hall with the New York Phil. That was not my thing. I so loved the ensemble and community element of music. Like I was the band geek of band geeks. And it wasn't because I was the best player. I worked hard and I was good and I had some natural ability, but I just so loved being part of an ensemble. That's really what drove me into it. And that truly is the same reason why I love writing.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter what form the writing is in, there's always a group of people that you have to interact with that are there to help make the story the best it can be. Whether even a novelist has an editor that they're working with, an agent. That's just how it works. And, that inherent collaborative part of the work is to me what really fuels me, because we spend so much time by ourselves, alternatively procrastinating and working that, when you get a chance to be with people, like for me, there's nothing more exciting than being on set.
Yeah.
Around all of these people who are bringing a script to life that was at one point something I scribbled down when I woke at 3 a.m. Right. on a notepad next to my, bed. That's amazing.
It's miraculous.
It really is. And they're all excited about it. And they, it's just the whole universality of the connection between people that creates is, I think, fascinating and rewarding.
Yeah. And I feel like in filmmaking, especially, that's true because having made a lot of things at this point, you realize that any one person who isn't working at their full potential, the end product is going to show it. So everybody kind of has to fire on all cylinders, and it's this kind of ultimate collaborative process that you're one part of that machine.
It really is. And I'm always amazed. It never ceases to sort of overwhelm me that, like, how much better it gets when all of these other really smart, talented people start looking at a script and saying, what if?
Yeah. And it elevates. Yeah.
I was never very interested in the solo element of music.
Yeah.
And it didn't help that I played the tuba. So there's not a lot of call for that.
Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I feel like that upbringing might have influenced your writing habits a good bit, because I mean, doing music, that's something that if you don't practice every day, you're never going to get good at it, right? Did that influence kind of your writing habits at all?
Yeah. I mean, it made a very natural segue. Like, I see a lot of writers struggle, and I listen and I talk to a lot of writers. I do a lot of consulting, and one of the big issues that we talk about is finding time. And, when you take, there's almost always a day job involved, and that's really hard. I did it for 15 years. And, but even when you set that aside, it's still difficult to figure out how to make that happen. And I think you're right when you say, that as a musician, there's a period of 6 or 7 years for me where it was, I was in a practice room for 7 or 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
That was just how you did it. And that was on top of classes, and I was taking a full load of classes. And so that was, that's tough. I mean, your worldview kind of becomes, oh, this is how it works. And so for me, in figuring out how I work as a writer, that kind of pavement was already laid, I think, in a way. And so that part of it wasn't such a huge struggle. There were other things that were definitely a struggle within that framework. So after a while, what I figured out after a few years of trial and error, it was morning is my time. I have a really difficult time writing starting probably around 1 or 2 in the afternoon.
When I want to fall asleep too. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's even beyond just getting tired. It's just sort of the mental acuity that it takes, for certain parts of what we do. Like I've had so much happen during the day already, that has sort of encumbered my brain, what little I have. It's, by that time in the day, it's sort of like, I can't marshal it. I can't, and I don't want to turn to substance abuse to make that happen. So, so I've learned, I start early in the morning. That's what works for me.
And when you're writing first thing in the morning, are you closing yourself off to all outside influences? Like, are you like, okay, no looking at email, no looking at internet, or are you kind of free to go back and forth between those things mentally?
I'm not. I know some writers can. So I've one of the things that's tough is internet, is because I'm constantly, especially when I'm working early in a process with note cards and outlining, Like it's kind of this very fluid movement between what it is I'm putting on paper or typing and looking something up. It's like a constant churn for me. It's like, oh wait, I need this detail about this street in this city at this time period or whatever right. It is, you know?
Right.
And
yeah.
And so the internet it's kind of become invaluable to me during that. I'm not real good at saying, okay, well, I don't have to answer that now. I'll just put X's in for that. Let me make a list of things to look up later and then I'll come back and populate them.
Right. Yeah.
That's not how I work. So
yeah.
The internet is good. What I've figured out though is I have a piece of free software that I've downloaded called Self Control. And what you do is you populate it with all of the places that you want to kind of block out.
And the time wasters.
Yeah. And you start it and, you know, and you pick the amount of time and how long you want to block for, and you click go, and then those things just aren't accessible anymore.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So you can still Google the facts that you need for your script or, you know, your thesaurus or whatever, but then Facebook is blocked.
Or whatever it is. Like for me, I have this compulsion during baseball season. I'm a huge baseball fan. Uh-huh. Like I am constantly checking scores constantly.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And, which is ridiculous. So, but I have a list, you know, they call it the blacklist on this app. It's called Self Control, and it's, you just, the list of sites that are verboten during it when it's active. And mine's,
that's cool. That's a cool
it's up to about 300 now. I've got 300 things on there. I find myself like so desperate to waste time that I'm like trolling Etsy for something I don't need or whatever. But it's great. That's helped me a lot. And what I do, I let myself, like, I'll set it up for, I usually do an hour and a half, and then I give myself 10 minutes to go to the bathroom, get something to eat, whatever, something to drink, surf wherever I want to go in the World Wide Web. And then, set a timer of 10 minutes and then I'm back at it. I started again. Yeah.
I write in a very similar way where I will, I don't have any software, but just for 30 minutes, I'll set a timer and I'm not allowed to do anything else, you know, except write. Yep. And I do this thing where, it's this trick where I'll have my script open and then I have like a random notepad open. And so for 30 minutes, I don't stop typing. So I have to either work on the script or work on outlines or work on random lines that pop into my head in the note document. And then after that timer goes off, I allow myself to get up, walk around, grab a drink, check internet, whatever, and then come back and do another sprint like that. And it almost always goes over to, you know, 45 minutes for an hour easily.
Right. It's kind of amazing. Once you get going, that's, you know, that was always a struggle for me early on, is how do you just get going?
Right.
You know, and it depends where I am in the process. To me, when actually going to script, that's the easiest for me to get going because I just kind of back up a few pages from where I left off yesterday. And I just kind of start going through that and tweaking, and it just kind of eases me right into whatever's next. And I kind of keep going. For me, it's much harder earlier in the process when I'm either breaking the story by myself or going from note cards to sort of a prose outline. That to me,
it's harder to get into that flow.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. That's great. So that's kind of your writing habits. You talked about writing in the morning. When do you find time for, you know, all the networking side of, I guess in your case, as a working writer, you're meeting with agents and managers and having to talk to producers and return emails and all that kind of stuff. Is that a specific time of your day, or is that once you're done writing, it's anything's possible?
Yes. So there's always exceptions, but generally I write between like 6 and 10 or 5 and 9 in the morning. 6 and 10 is usually what happens. And then I try to take a little bit of break, do something physical, whether it's walk the dog, take a yoga class. Those are my two go-tos. Eat some lunch. And then I generally ask my manager to schedule meetings in the afternoons. Okay. And one thing I have realized is almost always people give you, like, whenever they're setting a meeting, it's like, here's 3 days and here's 3 times in each day that work for us. So, gotcha, and almost one is always in the afternoon. So I try to do like leave between 1 and 6 for meetings. or any other kind of discussion that needs to happen, notes calls, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But it's not interrupting your writing time.
No, I've really, it's, you know, when I was working full time, it was such a struggle. I got to get the time that I got so protective of it. And that was actually the best thing that could have happened, was learn how to protect that time, because that's where it all happens. Really, yeah, and
that's
truly,
great.
You know,
so what do you say to someone who is just they still have that day job and they have a family and they have all these things that are taking away from their writing time? How do they get that first foot in the door of setting a daily habit like that?
Well, if you know, I think anytime you have someone else involved, it complicates things. For sure. I'm incredibly lucky that I have a husband who is 1000% supportive of all this. You know, he has been from the get-go. We moved in together about 6 months before I went to graduate school, and he actually made the choice to move with me all the way across the country to Pittsburgh to do this. And then we came back here. So he's all in on that. And so I'm very fortunate that way. He also works in the industry. He's not on the writing and producing and directing side of things. He works in the back end. He's in production accounting now. He worked in human resources before. So he understands kind of at least at the very basic high level, sort of like what this entails and the difficulties involved. And so he's always really helpful around, you know, giving me that space. If I say I need 3 hours today to do this, he's down with that, and he'll like take the dog somewhere so there's no barking, and you know, and being helpful. So I think that's kind of key. Like if you don't have that kind of, or some version of that support, I think it's really, really difficult because then everything is conflict. So let's assume that all that's good, that, you know, like,
I do think you can navigate that in some way. And I think communication is key of being very specific of, hey, during these hours, I need this time closed off. And I think also starting small,
like, yes.
Hey, can I, 30 this half minutes hour. A day, I'll wake up a half an hour earlier, to start writing. And I need that time for myself if I cannot be bothered. And also I think writing seasonal a lot. I mean, I know when you're trying to break in, it seems like you have to work 100% of the time, but I think you can find windows that are maybe less busy. So, you know, maybe with kids, it's during the summer, you have a little bit more free time when they're not on a schedule that you can really kick ass at writing. And then maybe during the school year, because I was a single dad for a long time. And I just kind of recognized that time with my son was priority during that moment in my life. And so now that he's older, I have more time to put towards that and more time to, you know, get out and make things and take weeks off and that kind of stuff.
Those are terrific points, I think. And I certainly didn't mean to sound doom and gloomy earlier at all. It just complicates. But I think you're right. I think starting small is key. You know, okay, I'm going to this half hour or this 45 minutes or this hour, that's manageable. Getting up early is a big one. I've always done that. I've always been a morning person. And you know, when I do talk with other writers and like, oh, I just, you know, I'm a late night guy, or, you know, my best time is between 6 PM and 10 PM. I think, oh my goodness. Like that's sort of prime time for everybody, for everything to be happening. And so I always, you know, and you're coming home from a job, and it's, you know, even if it's sort of like the most mundane job in the world, you're still kind of pooped. So that's always sort of my first question is, can you get up an hour earlier and give yourself, say, you know what, I'm going to write one page in that hour.
Yep.
You know, because if you do that, then 3 months later, you're going to have a feature script.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's
amazing those tiny windows, how they add up so quickly.
Yeah, for sure. And then it's about prioritizing too. I think one of the things that's tough, you know, for those of us who choose to go this route, you know, we see a lot of other friends who have an infinite amount of free time, seemingly, you know, who they've got a 9-to-5 job that they can absolutely just leave there and it's done. You know, but we have to make some choices. It's, you know, for this 6 months, I can't go to this party. You know, I can't go out with, you know, everybody's going out for dinner on this night. I'm just not gonna be able to do it. Because I have to get this done.
Yeah.
And I find that when I communicate that with people who are close to me, and let them know what, you know, why they're supportive. They love it. And then they, you know, and then they ask about it and they're like, well, how's it going? I'm like, you know, and you're just banging my head against the,
Thanks for asking.
Yeah, yeah. But it's the communication element of is really, really important. So I would say, yeah, start small, see if you can do it in the morning before your day begins, before the world is up asking you for everything. That's a big help. And even
I'm a big believer in morning times too, because I think especially when you're working a day job, you get home and you're just exhausted, and that's the worst time to be creative. So I'm a big pusher. I mean, a lot of people, like you said, work at night, and I just don't get it for that very reason. Like, I don't understand how you get more motivated and have more energy at the end of a day after you've been through everything.
Yeah, it's I can get a little bit of burst if I do some sort of like exercise at 6 o'clock. Uh-huh. I can kind of. All right, I can sit down for, you know, between 7 and 8 or 7 and 8:30 and get a little something done. But even that's not the kind of like real focus that I can get at 6 or 7 in the morning. One thing I have found is a lot of people who say I write better at night, they're the ones who tend to sleep late.
Right.
And this is anecdotal, but I've found that they tend to sleep late and go to bed late. And so it's really like a different, it's kind of a whole different version of a day. But in the end, whatever works for you, if you, wherever you can carve out an hour or two,
absolutely.
Or if you can squeeze in three, that's when to do it.
Yeah. So, we got a little derailed from your personal kind of writing journey. So when you were first starting out, did you have a clear goal of like where you wanted to be and how you wanted to get there? And, how did your actual story vary from that goal?
I did, and it varied completely. I started off as a playwright, and that's all I was interested in. And then it was feature film. And somebody, a very close friend, and who's also a writer, a successful writer now, pointed out, they're like, everything you write about is perfect for television. Why are you not doing that? And it took me a real, and this is sort of before peak TV and television became the place to go where the best stories were being told or so much great content was being created.
Yeah.
And I was really hesitant. At that point too, I was also kind of embroiled in the feature world in development. And so that had pulled me away from what I was trying to, what I thought I wanted to do. It didn't help. I was pretty good at development. You know, it's one of the few skills that I have is being able to read a script, talk with writers, talk with directors or producers, and kind of help them find solutions. And so it was easy to kind of get derailed into that. And eventually I made the choice. I'm like, look, you went to school, you took on all this debt. This is what you said you've wanted to do. Get back to it. And so I did.
Yeah.
But I really thought like it was playwriting. That was going to be my thing. Because as a writer, kind of for me, the entry point into everything is almost always is dialogue. It served my playwriting very well. But it just, you know, the more I spent time out here and the more I worked in filmed entertainment and entertainment for the screen, the more I just came to love the process of it and the people. Not that theater people aren't amazing. They are. It's kind of where my heart will always lie. But I just kind of click with this form, at least at this point in my life. So So it's very different than when I went to school. I was gonna graduate and move to New York. That was my plan. And somehow get something off Broadway and then eventually on Broadway.
So how did you end up in LA, and then what was that journey to the TV side of things like, since that wasn't at all what you set out to do?
Well, LA was kind of a compromise because I had my mother at the time when I first moved here. She was ill, and they're up in the Bay Area. My family is up in the Bay Area. And so LA was like, oh, it's, you know, it's still entertainment. I could still kind of, there's theater there, and but I could pop up to see the family, you know, every other weekend.
Right, yeah.
And at work, that was great, but it was kind of just being out here is where I got hooked into film and television, of course.
Yeah.
And so I started, like I said before, when I left the feature world, and it took me a few years of kind of just floundering around and trying to find like sort of find my niche and my voice again. And I actually started to apply for a couple of fellowships. And that's what sort of really pushed me into TV.
Okay.
I never got any of them.
were they TV specific yes. fellowships?
Yeah, the Warner Brothers, the Disney ABC. I've been a finalist 3 times, but never got picked, and that's okay because the real benefit from all that was it was sort of like a crash course being immersed in figuring out all of the differences in the formal differences between film and television. Gotcha. You know, I wrote, 30 specs. And then I started writing pilots once pilots were, you know, and so in doing that, it was just sort of this kind of self-imposed, you know, like master's program for me in trying to figure that out and learn as much as I could. And that's sort of what happened. And then I wrote a couple of TV movies, which is sort of a hybrid of the two.
Right, yeah.
Because they're feature length, but they move like TV. And so that's kind of that's how I kind of got to where I am.
Gotcha. So what was the big kind of breaking in moment for you then is there not something you can point to? It's all just kind of gradual.
Yeah, it's just been this very slow moving mass that's still moving, you know, hopefully will continue to move. There's, you know, I did have one script it won a bunch of contests a couple of years ago. It was a pilot. And that's how Jenny at Finish Line, it won that.
Right, yeah.
That contest among some others. But that script was when I finally figured out sort of who I was as a writer. And that's, I think my voice, I finally trusted what I was doing and stopped giving a shit about what other people thought enough to let my voice just land on the page the way I really, really felt it.
Which is an amazing lesson that the moment that you really embraced who you were on the page was the one that kind of got the most attention for you.
It is. And it had, at the time, it had everything stacked against it. Yeah. Like everything stacked against it. It was a female lead, which of course today that's all everybody wants.
Right.
It was a female lead. It was period based in the '70s, the mid 70s.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And it was filled with people of color.
Yeah.
Like at that, you know, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, you'd think I'm saying 20 years ago. It was just 2 years ago.
It is an eternity in Hollywood. Yeah.
Right. It's, you know, and the way the world is changing around us. But at that time, even like people just weren't, they wouldn't respond to it. They wouldn't. You know, and in that way. But I think the writing, you know, was strong enough and compelling enough that's kind of what made people sit down and say, okay, let me talk to this guy and see what he's about and see what else he has to say and what else he's working on. I think that would be sort of like the one or not the, if I had to isolate a thing, that's sort of what allowed the mass to keep moving forward.
Right.
You know, but that was after, I mean, years and years of figuring out of writing and rewriting and learning, okay, well, I can do this better because of that. What wound up guiding me through all of this was how do I make what I'm writing infinitely readable without losing what I want to say? Because once you're established, you kind of have a little bit more leeway, you know, and you know, for the big established writers, you know, for an example, when I was in development, we got a rush submission on a Friday afternoon on a script. It was a feature script, there was going to be, you know, it was out to bid and everybody was reading it. And, you know, by 5 o'clock they had to have answers. And it was by an incredibly established writer, a feature script that was 171 pages.
Yeah.
Right. And I read this and I, you know, my first line in the write up was, this isn't a film. It's not a film. Yeah. This is a play.
Yeah.
Right. But here's what works. Here's what doesn't. Here's why.
Gotcha.
You know, but they could do that, you know, and the reality of today is that everybody calls them gatekeepers. There's a whole bunch of people, right, that are reading our scripts just to say whether or not their boss should read a paragraph synopsis that they're going to put together, right? Yeah. Most of those folks are very young. That's not to say that they're not smart.
They're just entry-level jobs, right?
They tend to be younger and very poorly paid and way overworked. So they're not spending time, you know, they don't have, you know, the luxury of time to really dive into anything and ask lots of critical questions. And they're not incentivized by the system, a risk-averse system, to say yes or to say, hey, how about this, right?
Yeah.
So, and, you know, then you throw in all the, you know, the existing IP issues that people only want stuff that's familiar and all these other things. And that just kind of gets me, it's I'm getting to this bigger idea that what we write has, you know, and how we lay it on the page has big consequences. You know, and if somebody doesn't read your script, then your voice isn't going to be heard. So it's finding that balance, you know, I think early on of making something infinitely readable without pandering is really important.
So unpack that a little bit of the idea of readable. So what does that mean to you? And when you're using that phrase?
I think it's a combination of things. It's, you know, I think people always point to formatting, which I don't want to dismiss. But it's really about, like, you know, I think it's keeping the reader in the story and, like, you know, and not pulling them out, not doing things that pull them out, whether it's a logic issue, you know, wait a minute. In the last scene, this person was in Utah and now without any explanation, they're in Pennsylvania.
Right.
You know,
and those are the things in the scripts that if you're crossing your fingers, hoping no one will notice, everyone will notice.
Yeah. And that's a kind of a logic issue. And then there's the formatting side of stuff when, you know, and there's been just recently, there have been just like lengthy Twitter threads by some really great writers and very successful working writers about formatting and like camera and all that stuff. My thought is just, I just leave all that stuff out and I just try to write it so that the reader imagines whatever that shot is.
Right. Because your first audience is that reader.
Yeah. And I just want them to love, mostly what I want them to do, I just want them to fall in love with the characters.
Right.
I want them to desperately know what's going to happen to these characters, especially for TV. You know, not that film isn't either, but, you know, with TV, we keep coming back week after week, right? Or whatever it is to watch these characters. So trying to write it that way that minimizes people stopping and asking questions or having to go back and pick something up. There's also, and this comes from consulting and reading thousands and thousands of scripts over the last 10 years is, you know, we tend to overstuff everything as writers. And, you know, I have a mentor who's so good. He's worked in TV for I think 2 decades now, and he's so good at it. And the thing I've walked away from him with, and it's such a simple working with him, it's such a simple idea. And that is there's only one thing that happens in a scene. And when that thing when the accomplishment or when either the objective is fulfilled or thwarted, that scene is over and it's time to move on.
Wow, and I find that, great.
Yeah, so often we have multiple, it's almost like reading really early drafts, but people are saying, oh, this is my 12th draft, but there's still like 7 things happening in a scene.
Right.
And I don't know what, I don't, as a reader, I don't know what I'm supposed to be hanging on to here. Like how am I supposed to follow that line and for you to generate the tension and the excitement that you want around that? When I'm looking over here and then over here and I'm considering that and this, it's just too much. You know, and I think a lot of when I talk with writers about it, and I'm guilty of it too, is, you know, I think we're all voracious readers and novels, you can do that.
Right.
in a prose form, you can move all over the place and fill things in a very different way than you can, in a screenplay or a teleplay. So that's part of, you know, when we talk about unpacking readability, it's overstuffing it is a really, really big issue. And the last part of it is, I think we've gotten so inundated with, what I call dogmatic formulas in the industry, that, you know, there's all these books that tell us sort of what structure is.
Right.
You know, and they're all good. I mean, they all have
right.
stuff to learn
from. Yeah.
But the problem is, so many of those gatekeepers, I think that's kind of, everything has to fit something in there.
Mm.
Has to fit one of the, whatever their favorite is.
Right.
And it doesn't.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And we tend to write to that. as opposed to going to those and saying, okay, I have this issue in my script. How can I solve that? You know, and using those as resources versus it being sort of necessarily like a hard and fast template. And I think that affects readability too.
Yeah.
You know, we shoehorn stuff in, but it's all tends to be very plotted as opposed to the emotional arc of a character.
Letting the characters carry it. Yeah.
Yeah. Or, you know, or assessing that and really inform, letting the script be about that. Cause somebody once said, and I can't remember who, and I wish I could, because I need to give them massive credit, but it's the plot is just the manifestation of the character's change.
Hmm.
And I go back to that all the time when I get stuck. I'm like, wait a minute, how is this character changing? And how does this plot point actually enable that or get in the way of it?
Right.
Like how is that in the larger process here? What is this doing? And so often it's not, or it's a repeated beat because I'm not thinking about, or I haven't thought through enough and been clear enough about what the character is about here. And I see that a lot when I read for clients, is that's missing. So all of those together, when you put like that and the formatting and overstuffing scenes, you know, and trying to write to Save the Cat or Sid Field or whatever it is. Like when you put all that together, that kind of becomes readability. But I think that the real part of it is voice.
Yeah.
Is something that stands out as, you know, it, people put words on the page and arrange them in such a way that it's just got this passion and fire to the characters and the description that makes you keep reading.
Yeah.
Like that voice and it's unique.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Unique to every person. And I think where that comes from is when you are so 110% passionate about what you're writing, that comes through on the other side. And that's where those things with, like, you know, the plotting books and Save the Cat and all that get in the way, is you're trying to check those boxes instead of writing something that you're exciting about. You're writing a term paper instead of a poem, right?
Right. I think you bring up a really good point, and that is it's kind of like I use those references. I may consult them early on
right.
when I'm note carding.
Yeah, outlining.
But then it becomes like, once I start filling in any kind of detail, and that's usually when I go from note cards to outlines, because for me the note cards are pure plot. Like, it's all plot. It's yeah. just making sure that this makes sense. And once I start going to outline, that's when I just stop thinking about that. And I've trust that I've laid out the big milestones. I'm going to hit them. You know, they're going to make sense. They're going to feel organic. And I just start writing. And once I learned to do that, that's when my writing changed.
That's
when
great.
I stopped being really, really worried about trying to please a reader. Because it's something that they'll get, and just being confident and letting that stuff flow. That's when the rewrite became much more enjoyable, because I was like, okay, this is a great nugget to keep.
Right,
this
yeah.
is, you know, I don't need that. This is just repeating that, or it's pulling us off the line of action here. This is, you know, like, that's a great detail about this character. Of course they hide their drinking. Why would they not, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so it's once, and all of that kind of becomes your voice, but, you know, just kind of letting it flow and then reworking it versus trying to control it as it comes out is, for me, that's kind of how I found my voice.
Love that. So I wanted to ask one more kind of habit question, and then we'll wrap up here. But what's your writing environment? Like, do you have a specific space that you write in? Do you listen to music? Do you put certain things on your wall? What's all that like?
That's a great question. It depends on which part of the process I'm in.
Oh, okay.
So when I'm breaking story and note carding, I have a, in my garage, I pull my car out and I have a big whiteboard that's revealed behind the car. And I have a card table that I set up with a chair. And that is it.
It's like your fantasy sports draft room.
It's kind of, yeah. I mean, there's nothing to distract me out there. And so I usually will spend, I spend about 60-65% of my time generally in that part.
Okay.
In that phase of any project.
Yeah.
But I got to be there to do it. There's no music involved at all.
Yeah.
And it's just going to the board, putting everything up there. Okay. This seems like it could be a good scene. This seems like it could be a scene. And then kind of, okay, now let's start shuffling these into an order. Yes. This kind of makes sense. Great. You know what? That's repeated. We don't need that. Maybe that's another episode or something, you know, and sort of forming it into this thing. And then from there, once I'm happy with kind of how that lays and I think, okay, this makes sense. And I've had some people, a couple of trusted advisors kind of take a look at it and let me walk them through it. And they're like, yeah, that makes sense. Change this, try this. Once I'm happy, then I start outlining. And I'm still in the garage with that. And that's just transferring cards to a beat sheet. And the way I do it is it's one bullet point, one line, a bullet point per scene.
Okay.
So it's
so it helps you focus and figure out the point of that scene.
It's incredibly ruthless.
That's so good.
Right. And then after that, once I'm comfortable with that, that's when I can kind of go somewhere else. And I have a rotation of, I've got two libraries close by.
Okay.
And three coffee houses. And usually at this point I go to the libraries because I'm still kind of, it's still, really active discovery time. Like I'm still kind of figuring stuff out and I need the quiet. And from that I turn it into sort of like a prose document. It's usually around between 10 and 15 pages.
And in that moment, you're getting more into character and all that.
That's kind of where the big discoveries are around character details, the world coming to life, all that stuff.
Gotcha.
And then once I'm done with that, that's when, I mean, I've had noise canceling headphones on everywhere. Then once I'm there, then I've got some music that I do like to listen to. I'll make a playlist for the script, but none of it has words. I can't do that. I don't know how people do that. It baffles me and I admire them to no end.
Me either. Especially people that work while like the TV's going, like it drives me crazy.
No. And I would offer those folks whenever I talk with writers too. I'm like, I think that, you know, I would bet if you do an experiment, you're going to find yourself, if you turn that off, you're going to find yourself frustrated because you've actually been distracted by that.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's tough. It's really, really tough. So, So once I do that and then going to draft, which is usually like, honestly, 5% of the time is that I'll have the music on and it's basically just taking what I've done in a treatment, and that treatment has slug lines in it already. It's just kind of flushing that out and turning it into actual script formatting.
That's great.
Finding some more dialogue, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I do the same thing with playlists. I'll create one for each movie. And again, absolutely no vocals at all. But I find that that's a nice kind of shortcut to getting into flow because you put that music on and you're used to listening to that music and writing that script, that it's kind of a shortcut.
Oh, no, for sure. And it's funny how it works, too, if it's appropriate. Like a script that I did, a TV pilot called Sugarland. It's the one I mentioned earlier. It takes place in the 70s in Texas. Right. And the soundtrack was so much fun to put together because it's like all the 70s country and Western stuff. But there's a song that I threw in the playlist by Barbara Mandrell called Sleeping Single in a Double Bed. And it became, so there's a scene, there's a particularly important scene in there that it's about their marriage. Yeah. And it's kind of showing the cracks in their marriage. And this scene, that song got so wedded to that in my mind, to that scene, yeah. I couldn't work on it without it.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so I actually wound up, I'm like, you know what? Screw it. And I threw it in. Yeah. I actually threw it into the script.
Wrote it in. That's awesome.
It's a great moment, I think.
Yeah. All right. So we'll wrap up with five rapid fire questions. So you just answer them quickly. What do you write?
I write about underdogs. I write about families, whether nuclear, blood, or otherwise, and social justice.
All right. What's your proudest accomplishment?
My proudest accomplishment as a writer is having written some things where people have read them and said, I know these people. These are people that I know, and their problems I've heard them express, and it makes me feel less alone.
Oh man, that is so powerful. And that's like my goal in everything that I write. And you'll see that a lot of, even on the Scriptblast website, it's all about letting people know they aren't alone, whether it's the screenwriting stuff I do or the actual writing stuff I do. Because that to me is the whole purpose of film. Like that's why it exists.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
It's beautiful. How do you define success?
Success is for me is when people that I've worked with say that they've had a great time doing what we've done together, and they know somebody else they want to bring in to work with us next time.
Mm, God, I love that. What writers do you most look up to and why?
Oh God, I hate this question so much. Like,
because you have too many.
It changes as I get older and
yeah.
I really, really like I love what Nora Ephron did.
Yeah.
You know, there was something about her, that just spoke to me. You know, there's so many, I should have prepared for this. I'm not, this is like, what are you watching?
It's on the spot. Yeah.
I know.
All right. We'll move on.
There's a lot, you know, I'm like John Logan. Like I love his work.
Yeah.
I mean, I adore his work. Alfonso Cuarón, stuff's great. There's so many. We're just drowning in great writers.
Yeah, that's awesome. Finally, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Oh my gosh. The advice that I would give to my younger self would be, there's a couple of things. One would be, don't be so fucking afraid. Mm-hmm. Because nobody knows what they're doing.
That's so good. And so true.
It is.
Yeah.
We're all just kind of bumbling through it. Yeah. The other part of it would be, tell the people in your life that you care about how much you care about them all the time.
Mm.
Whether it's family, friends, colleagues, let them know that you're grateful that they're there.
God, that's so good.
I didn't do enough of that when I was young.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's next for you, and what are you working on now that you can talk about?
Oh my goodness. What am I working on now? I've got three projects right now in the hopper, and I'm doing a massive amount of research on one, on a fourth. The research is a queer Western.
Wow.
Which is something I've wanted to write for 15 years.
That's awesome.
And I finally feel like confident enough. And as I said before, that I just don't give a shit what anybody thinks anymore to write it.
Right.
But
yeah,
the project that I'm doing, it's something, I mean, I loved Westerns as a kid. Growing up, they were always sort of like on Saturday morning TV. And so just by osmosis, they were on. But I was always drawn to the panorama of it all, you know, and sort of like the mythology of it. And as I've gotten older and realized just how horrendous it all was, it's been a struggle to reconcile all that. So I'm in the middle of this project right now of 100 Westerns in 100 days. And I'm watching. Wow. Yeah. And so it's a book called Renegade Westerns, and I'm working my way through it. And it kind of gives a brief overview of 100 Western movies that sort of, for one reason or another, sort of bucked the genre or moved it forward or did something different. So I'm about a third of the way through that right now. When I finish it, I'm gonna write that feature.
So you're not exclusively in TV. You're still playing with other things.
Gotcha. Oh yeah. Yeah. And so I anticipate probably starting that like at the end of the summer.
Great.
But right now I'm working on an adaptation of a very small it's a small feature. It's an adaptation of a really, really thoughtful and powerful short film script that somebody wrote. That's an assignment that I'm on, which is great.
Cool.
And then I'm rewriting a pilot that I wrote last year for my manager. He's going to be taking that out soon. And then another pilot, a half hour pilot, a dramedy that my management team loathed, but I am never, ever going to give up on. I'm kind of reconceiving that one a little bit.
Cool.
Yeah. So.
And then where can people find you on and around the internet if they want to keep up with you?
Very few places. Twitter is about it.
Okay, great. What's your Twitter handle?
At RB Ripley.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, man. This was just absolutely incredible, and I feel a real kind of kinship to you just after talking for an hour.
Oh, this has been great, and I'm so grateful that you're doing what you're doing, and helping out writers and giving them sort of a really interesting peek into the world of and how other people operate, but most importantly, sort of, I don't know, you're kind of highlighting the universal that we're all sort of stumbling through this in the best way we can. And knowing that we're not alone is hugely helpful.
For in a lot of people's eyes, you know, they would look at me and see me as successful, and I don't necessarily see myself like that. And I imagine that you'd probably say the same thing. But even I need to be reminded of all this stuff all the time, that you never arrive, you know?
No, there is no arrival. That's what I learned as a musician. There is no arrival point. It's just a constant sort of reworking, reinvention, and learning. And it's a big evolution, and that's all that matters.
Love it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Rob. I really appreciate all this.
Oh, thank you, Hudson. I'm really grateful for the time.
Thanks again to Rob for chatting with us, and thanks to you for listening. As always, we're going to leave you with an assignment for the week. This week, I want you to write down one new habit that you will implement in your life this month. Maybe you take Rob's advice and write just one page a day. Maybe it's setting a boundary of writing 30 minutes each day uninterrupted by work or family. Or maybe it's sacrificing one thing for 30 days, like Netflix, and replacing it with writing. But doing one activity for 30 days straight, and I promise you, you'll see a massive increase in your productivity. Remember, you can find Rob at RB Ripley on Twitter. And don't forget, if you're looking for a screenplay competition that not only gives winners real, legit access in Hollywood, just like Rob got, but gives you notes on your screenplay so you can rewrite it and re-enter it for a better chance to win, check out finishlinescriptcomp.com. And if you enter through Film Freeway, you can save 25% off using the coupon code ACA25. If you're looking for community and accountability to go with your new habits, come find us at Script Blast's private Facebook group or download more free resources at scriptblast.com. If you've got a question you'd like us to answer on the show or want to share some of your writing productivity hacks, please email me at hudson@scriptblast.com. Next week, we'll talk with comic book writer and filmmaker Van Jensen all about work-life balance. Until then, keep writing.